Oh, well, so we're very lucky to have Renee here tonight and be able to have this conversation. So Renee and I are going to, be asking each other questions back and forth just to unpack gender, some of it from a more, just diving into the Dharma aspects of it and some a little more just our personal experience of how that's been for us. So I just wanted to start out, Renee, just by asking you your thoughts on how the Dharma can help guide us into inquiry about gender.
First of all, I just want to say, this is one of my favorite formats to be, in dialogue as we explore the Dharma together. And it's, particularly as one of my Dharma siblings from Community Dharma Leaders, it's like getting to come back into some of those conversations together. For me, in my, having the opportunity to kind of experience a lot of changes in my own body, having gone through a gender transition journey that included, taking hormones, is kind of like going through adolescence in my late 40s with 20 years of practice. So, it's quite an experience, and I think having the benefit of my practice, there's such an amazing opportunity to observe and to kind of like be like, what do I notice about all of this? And in particular, what do I notice about gender going through this process and going from kind of a social location of female-ish? I never identified with that, but nonetheless, our society identified me as female, and moving into a male social identity, it was like, it's great to just bring in this question, like, actually, what are these identities? Like, is there any point in this process when I felt like, oh, I feel male now? I'll say no, that never has happened. To notice even as my body changed, as I start to grow a beard, like, oh, does this feel male? No, what does male even feel like in the sensations in the body in our direct experience? So I think one concept that's really come up for me is kind of like just the relative and relative reality and absolute or ultimate reality. Like in this relative reality, though I can't locate any experience of gender in my sensations in my direct experience, nonetheless, I'm treated very differently based on these changes in my appearance. And so there's like this is this like very big impact on my day-to-day life of like moving through the world being more or less always perceived as male, whereas in in my previous identity, often people couldn't figure out what my gender was, and that created a lot of anxiety. So suddenly, like just going to the bathroom, just going through a TSA line, all of these things are suddenly so much more easeful because of having like a gender that's clearly read by everyone. So it's like the relative impact of gender is like really big in my experience. And then at the same time, when I tune into like, what is this? I cannot find it anywhere. So in that kind of more ultimate level, I just have to ask the question, like, does gender even exist? Because I cannot find it in my direct experience. So I could that could be a whole talk right there, but I'm gonna pause and just I'm curious for you, Kitty, like how does your experience of gender kind of like how does that show up in your own mindfulness practice or in the within the context of the Dharma?
Yeah, thank you. As I've gone toward anticipating having this conversation, I've been thinking about this a lot more and just realizing My desire to be a good Buddhist and a good ally, like I just completely jumped over Wise View in many ways to get to Wise Speech. And I don't want to say the wrong thing, and I want to be respectful, and I want, just all of that, that sort of pressure, and thinking I'm going to get it right, and being really upset when I don't get it right, if I don't say the right thing, like all of those impulses. I mean, we're all, we've all experienced that, I'm pretty sure. And realizing what is wise view, a right view about gender. And the more I've experienced with people, and the more I've taken a dive into it, it's a lot about realizing that there isn't, we're not going to get it right, and that everybody's story is just, fabulously unique, right? So that you can't get a fix on this is how it is for a trans woman, or this is how it is for an intersex man, or whatever their people's identity are, is. Yeah, so that really, like, just backing up into, let me just be open and keep gathering and be curious, like, instead of having that tension all the time, like, I'm not going to get the pronouns right. Yeah, that, and the concept that runs through the four foundations of mindfulness, especially about body, of that every way that we pay attention, it's encouraged to pay attention internally and externally. And I realized that I was making an error of, like, oh, all this stuff is up about gender, and it's like these people out there that I need to understand what's going on with them. And at the same time, being like, hang on, wait a minute, we haven't had any really deep conversations about all the stuff that's going on for women. Like, I was kind of upset inside about that. And then realizing, oh, like, wouldn't it be great for us to make some more room for all of us to be able to look at whatever we've been through about gender, because it's been good and suffering for all of us. We've all had that. So yeah, just to put as much importance on unpacking, well, what is really going on here for me? That's one of the best things I can do to be a good ally for people, is to understand myself. So yeah, that's what comes up.
And if I could just, like, riff onto one thing that you just said, which I really appreciated, is this, like, bringing in this piece of the four foundations of mindfulness, the refrain of the Satipatthana Sutta that invites us to bring our mindfulness to our internal experience, to our external experience, and then to both. And that both is the part that I find so interesting, and is, like, something I have been practicing with. It's actually become a little bit of a core piece of my practice, is, like, what does that both mean? What does it mean to have our to be bringing our mindfulness or our awareness to our internal experience and external at the same time? And for me, that really speaks to actually bringing our mindfulness into the relationship itself. And it's so, like, apropos to the very thing that you're talking about, this thing of, like, oh, I want to get it right, which is to say, like, I want to refer to this other person as they wish to be referred to, because in fact, there is no right or wrong. There's simply that we're in relationship with another being, and we want to be in, like, a attuned relationship to that other person, by respecting how they want to be referred to, their name, their pronouns, and any other aspects of their identity that are important. And for me, one place of just so much learning about that was in the first residential retreats that we offered to trans, non-binary, and gender expansive community, with also our CDL sibling, Fresh Lev White, and also JD Doyle, who's another, both our East Bay Meditation Center's teachers. As we brought these first groups together for residential retreat, one thing that was interesting was just in, like, the questionnaire, that you ask people to fill out, We had 50, retreatants, and in asking people their gender and pronouns, we had more answers than there were participants, at least in terms of gender. Or I think we mapped it out. There were 35 answers out of 50 people. So there's such a diversity of the way that people are identifying now, and I would say maybe particularly young folks, but all folks. And it's changing all the time. So myself, even as a trans-identified person, but also a person in my 50s, like I can't keep up. I can't keep up with the young people. They're changing all the time. And then sometimes we would have participants on our retreat that said, well, my pronouns are different on different days. Sometimes my name is different on different days. Like, so it's just this constant invitation back to, can we be mindful internally, externally, and both? Can we be attentive and attuned to this relationship even as it changes? And let go of getting it right, but instead be like continuing to check in if I'm use the wrong pronouns to just, be like, oh, just to correct myself, even just to do that correction. It doesn't even have to be a big apology or anything like that, but just to be like, oh, I caught myself. I am, or like, did I get that right? This caring and attuning to the relationship. Yeah, just curious if there's anything else, that's been for you that's like been a challenge around navigating this language, kind of this new language around gender and pronouns.
Yeah, there's certainly the wish to honor what it is that people how people want to be referred to and what names they want to be used and those kinds of things. And I got it wrong as much as anybody, and try to work with that. And I think there's a lot of parallels with racial work around race, just in that, like, oh, I said something wrong and now it's about me. Now it's like white fragility, but it's gender fragility or something like that. And it's painful to go there. It's painful to go to that place. So yeah, I expect to keep working with that, and lighten it up over time. It has been lightening up over time. But yeah, more recently, having had somebody be comment on the gender pronouns that I was using that weren't like, off the checklist sort of. Usually I just say she and her because that's how people perceive me. It's just, that's just the simplest, easiest thing. And just having somebody challenge something I said, I said, oh, my pronouns are she and we, and I was lectured on the side, which was really painful and not at all appropriate. It wasn't somebody who had a better bead on this stuff, but it really made me think. It really made me think, like what was up with me, like that there's something actually painful for me about saying she all the time. Like that, oh yeah, I don't really like to think about being in this group that's got less rights, that's minoritized, that I don't really like thinking, like, oh yeah, I'm she. It's like there's something about that piece of it that's painful. And then it just exploded into this whole hang on, and it's a generational thing, like what you're talking about, Renee. I've been gender nonconforming all my life. It's like what the whole hippie thing was about, and in junior high and high school, the guys are getting beat up for growing their hair a little bit longer. Like we were always doing that. And I certainly myself did a lot of. I just. In every way I could think of, I did things that were outside of the normal female box of what I was supposed to be allowed to do, and not ha didn't have any examples of. I didn't have anybody else, that I could see that was doing what I was doing, and so I got this like sort of huffy, hang on, we've been doing this a long time. And and just like, oh, right. So there's something to be offered from elders about, hey, you're making me think about what we went through, and I hope that cut some room for what's happening now. Maybe, maybe some of the things that where we took some hits for not getting in the box, I hope that's cut some of this room instead of, I was feeling like I don't like it's sort of like I didn't get to really decide or something, like I didn't really get to decide what my how I identified. I was supposed to pick this pronoun, and they saying they doesn't do anything for me, so I'm still going to use she and her. But yeah, it just put me into a whole really deep reflection and reclaiming a lot of what woman in their right mind would want to be gender conforming to what was on offer in the 1950s and 60s. And what man with or boy with any decent heart would want to stay on the track of what was offered? It's like I've always been around people who didn't want to do that. That's my whole life has been like that. So I know that's really different than the sense of wow, I need to, I need to change my gender. Like it's a really different experience, but it's a really it's my gender experience that the more I can, own that and not be, not feel so different, like what other people are going through isn't really so different. We're all navigating this strange territory that's so influenced by a culture that is not freeing, not very freeing. So, yeah.
Right. And yeah, and not really very free when it comes to gender. Like just feeling into that, like, oh, just that bodhisattva longing for all beings to be free, just recognizing this is an area where we haven't been very free and where suddenly some freedoms are opening up or some people are expressing themselves now in a much freer way. And also, there's a real backlash to that because it does really threaten some of the structures of our society. And I think it is absolutely no coincidence that we're seeing this backlash against trans, non-binary and gender non-conforming people at the same time that we're seeing this attack on abortion rights. Like these are freedoms that people are have been living into. Like freedom for our bodies, this bodily autonomy, and that really challenges some of the ways that gender's been very controlled. And I think one of the things I've been really struck by in some of the work that I've done with men is in like having some of the conversations about like gender conditioning for men. I'm speaking like of cis men who are born men, that they also feel quite coerced into some of those demonstrations of masculinity, even including things like bullying and violence and like behaving towards women in coercive ways. Like these are things that are that maybe they feel like they're expected to do or have to do to be men, and that there's also this level of coercion there. And one of the things I've been most like struck by in my heart is hearing men talk about how afraid they are, have been of other men. And so, I mean, I just feel like there's compassion in all directions here. Compassion, this is you were saying, like, who in their right minds would want to be in the very small box of femininity that was presented in the 1950s, but also who would want to be in the very small box of masculinity that was presented in the 1950s? Like these are terrible, like very unfree places. And just feeling the longing for everyone to be free and to really truly choose. Just one other story, and then I'm curious to turn it back to you. But I was leading a LGBT retreat last year, And we had a group of actually a lot of young folks and a lot and a very gender diverse group, a lot of non-binary people who were using they them pronouns. And we had just a few elders in our group. And you know, we could kind of like in our well, mostly we were in silence, so of course we weren't even using pronouns. But nonetheless, like, you know, we were using them in the opening circle and the conversation before we went into silence. And then when we came out of silence in the end, one of the elders in our group, who I think was in like 70s or 80s, like announced at the end that they were going to use they them pronouns, that they that had shifted for them over the retreat. And it was just like so beautiful to see, like, for an, you know, this isn't just young people. It was like, here's someone very late in life saying, actually, this is who I am. It was just really moving.
Yeah, there's somebody in a group I'm participating in now who's in his late 70s who's coming to that place and starting to doll himself up with nice scarves and stuff like that. I don't know that he goes by they yet, but or if he will do that, but yeah, it's yeah. There's been a permission being you know carved out by younger people that's having an effect back on older people. Yeah. Well, I know we were talking before, Renee, about like how we got our education about all this stuff along the way. There's so many different aspects and paths and differentiations about, you know, trans people and intersex people and et cetera, all of those things. So yeah, just the like how we learned about those things. Do you want to go first or should I?
I feel like I've just been talking a lot, so would you start and then I'll chime
Sure,
in?
yeah. So I moved to San Francisco in 1977, and I moved to the Castro District. I actually moved to San Francisco. I flew in on a Monday night and landed in the middle of the night, and that Tuesday was the day that Harvey Milk finally got elected as a supervisor of San Francisco. And I was living like a block and a half from his camera store. So, you know, I just was plunked in the middle of the everything. And so, you know, just years of, you know, the gay pride marches, all the drag and the, you know, the everything like that was all around. And people had different words for it back then. And I've done a lot of working and volunteering in the Tenderloin. And so there were a lot of trans women there, still are a good number of trans women there. That I didn't understand it at the time, but that being trans and especially going towards choosing to go towards the minoritized identity is so like you're not going to get a job if you do that. Maybe now you can, right? But not in Kentucky still or wherever, right? It's like it just puts you you know, you're so marginalized, and so the fact that a lot of people ended up in, you know, in poverty in the Tenderloin that were, you know, didn't even have the word transgender back then. But anyway, so you know, I knew a good bit of number of people back then that would transition back and forth and try to find their way through things. But then the thing that really, like, whew, just totally started to wake me up was I worked at the library for many, many years, and most often at the main library. So we would just see everything in San Francisco coming, walking through the door, you know, just everybody walked through the door there. And we would have these trainings once a month that you could go to. It was optional, but they were trying to help us learn about who's here, who's coming in, like how, you know, how can we be more sensitive to who the people are that might show up. So there was a trans woman from the EEOC, which I always forget what it's called, Equal Employment Opportunity Council. So she was on the council of, somebody saying I'm being discriminated against. She was part of that group. And she did a lot of trainings for people, and she told us a lot of things, but what really hit me, whoa, was learning about intersex people, that it was the habit, it was still the habit in San Francisco of doctors to pediatricians to somebody was born with ambiguous genitalia or both sets of genitalia, that they would surgically, make the choice and turn that person into a girl most often, and then they'd be given hormones in their teen years, and often it was hidden from them why. And it was like, oh my God, no wonder there's a lot of people walking around wondering what's what with them. So that was like a huge revelation, that they were just then, this is like 25 years ago at least, just then trying to work with pediatricians in San Francisco to stop doing that. So, and that's just one aspect of these, these things that happen for people about identity. That one really, it just, once I knew that, it just really changed everything. And then, of course, the whole, I don't know what the numbers are currently, but just, for trans people who are not validated, especially, younger trans people who are not validated, like the suicide rates being just astronomical. Like, you don't need to ask any more questions as far as I'm concerned after that. It was just like, yeah, let's help this. Let's bring this out. Let's, lift the lid, look in, like let it out, let it be seen, let it be known, let it not be the secret thing people carry and feel ashamed of. So, yeah.
Yeah, I especially appreciate you bringing in that last piece because I feel like there's been so much coverage in the news, especially about trans kids and trans youth. And like there's a debate around this, and there really isn't in the medical community. And yeah, that there's just like missing this message that's such an important one, which is that gender affirming care for young people is actually life-saving care. Like, it is actually something that's well documented to be just increasing these kids' likelihood to stay alive. And suicide is such a huge issue for trans, actually for trans people of all ages. Just think this so just came up for me even as I was thinking about, oh, when do I remember learning about these things? Like, well, first of all, it's funny, I was just looking through my baby book where my mother made notes about me, like for the first 5 years of my life. And it's just like it's real clear what's going on in those first 5 years. It's like as soon as I have choices, it's trucks and cowboy hats and like boy stuff. But then there's this like at three, it's like, oh, Renee doesn't want to wear dresses. And then four, it's like no dresses, underline, underline. So it's pretty cute. It's like, okay, it's right there, it's documented. I was definitely the trans kid, and but there was no concept of that. I was 4 years old in 1972, there was no concept about, I never ever even, didn't even hear about trans people until I was in my 20s. And I remember Kate Bornstein, who was a playwright, and I remember going to the play these plays, Hidden Agenda, and her work was really like mind blowing and expanding to me when I was probably like 25 or so. And then I was also thinking the first trans man that I remember hearing about was Lauren Cameron, who actually just passed in the last couple months of suicide. And it's just another heartbreaking to see someone who was such a pioneer and who influenced so many people's lives, including mine, and still. It's still so hard, So, yeah. It's, just so much here. And I
Yeah.
know that we're like the time, of course, goes by so fast when we're talking because it's so much fun. But I want one other thing I just wanted to say before we move into questions is just to point to our own lineage. You know, for myself as someone who's an insight practitioner and teacher, and I feel very rooted in the Theravada lineage. At the same time, I look at our lineage and the way that, like, despite, I feel like our, you know, the teachings of the Buddha inherently point to the non-dual nature of everything and gender, including gender. Nonetheless, we have a very gendered system, particularly in the monastic tradition that's come down to us from in the Theravada. I don't know as much about other lineages. And so just I like to say, because I think a lot of people don't know this, is that if as a trans person, I cannot ordain in any Theravada monastery that I'm aware of. You actually have to be cisgendered to take robes. And so it's just like just look at how rigid the system is within our lineage, and just holding the both and the, you know, both the incredible nourishment of these teachings and the ways that they're held in this very, very rigid, very patriarchal, very binary system. And also one in which every male monk is senior over every female monastic. You know, it is, there's been so much change and things happening in the bhikkhuni communities that is like so amazing, and we have such a long way to go. So I just wanted to mention that piece as well. Yeah, and I'm just curious, Kitty, what else for you it feels like? Oh, I gotta
Thank
say
you.
this before we
Yeah,
end.
no, I'm really glad you did. I wanted to include that too. When we were talking before about doing this conversation, and I was saying, oh, well, when people ordained, they kind of degender themselves in a certain way. By shaving their heads and putting on robes, and you were saying, well, the women do. Like, all right, okay, so the women are looking, coming to look more like men. and the men look, a little different than regular people, but that was just interesting to think about that way. And yeah, the first time I ever heard about what it's really like in the Asian countries was from Larry Yang, having ordained briefly. I'm not sure if he was in Thailand or where he was, but and he couldn't he just couldn't handle that gender stuff. It just seemed so wrong to him that he was in this position where even the a nun who'd been ordained for decades, he was senior to that nun, even though he just ordained, and that been standing in line for food, like the nuns would be at the end, like just yeah. So a lot of that is in the process of changing, especially in the U.S., U.K., Australia. There's been moves to just go, well, we're not going to do it that way anymore. And yeah, even being able to have full ordination was an issue, and that some women have just quite recently charged ahead with that, and it's part of, like, with all the things that are like a mess in this country, it's like I love that this can happen here, right? That we have a context where like people are going to support the women to go, yep, that needs to be changed. We can make new traditions. So yeah, just to watch the birth of that was quite extraordinary with the Alokavihara nuns and others. Yeah.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.